Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The real cost of high gas prices, the latest installment of Google's master plan, and what the internet is hiding from you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill, an international producer and marketer of food, agricultural, financial, and industrial products and services. Information at Cargill.com. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
From the studios of WNYC in New York City, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Thursday, today the 12th of May. Glad to have you with us. Sorry, though, to tee up the broadcast with something most of us see every day as we're out and about. Those placards at gas stations with prices that start with fours. We start there today because the Commerce Department reported this morning that consumers spent 0.5% more in April than we did in March. 0.5%, you say? No, not all that much, granted, but more than half of the increase was swallowed up by gas stations. The extra money that consumers are pumping into their cars is starting to drag down the rest of consumer spending, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
People who track the economy look for tipping points, key moments when consumer behavior shifts, like a ship turning at sea.
Especially when gas prices surpass a round dollar figure, there is a trigger point which actually causes downward movement in consumer mood.
Economist Chris Christopher at IHS Global Insight says we hit that trigger point around a week ago when the average price of gas topped $4 a gallon nationwide. Meaning the slowdown in spending in April on most everything except gas could turn into a decline this month or next. To test the theory, I headed to the 76 station where I usually gas up, and where financial advisor Mary Martinez was filling up her late model Caddy for $3.99 a gallon.
It honestly has a huge effect on me. I don't go as many places. I carefully route where I'm going, spend a lot less money on other things.
What are the things that go first?
New clothes, nights, restaurants, you know, different activities for my child to do I can't afford.
Retail analyst Marshall Cohen of the NPD Group says consumers may be in a state of gas price shock right now, but...
You know, if gasoline can get below four and then comes back to four again, that second time is going to have a lot less impact than the first time. So when you ask, is the consumer going to get used to it? History dictates that they do. They make adjustments.
Such as they start shopping for more fuel-efficient wheels. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Talking about spending is a handy way to get into our next story, because one of the most costly and lasting effects of the housing collapse and the financial crisis for taxpayers remains the $138 billion worth of bad mortgages backed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two mortgage companies that were taken over by the government just as the crisis got going, in case you didn't recall. Congress has been looking for a way to replace them for years, and they gave it their latest shot today with bipartisan support, as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Most members of Congress believe the fragile housing market needs some sort of government mortgage guarantee. That's the only way to keep interest rates and down payments affordable.
If you don't have some government backstop or some government support, the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage will go away.
That's California Republican John Campbell, who, along with Michigan Democrat Gary Peters, today introduced a bill to replace Fannie and Freddie with five smaller private companies. They would be chartered by the government to issue mortgage-backed securities with a taxpayer guarantee.
Without some government support like this, you can't get the marketplace to loan that much money for that long a period of time.
The replacements for Fannie and Freddie would have to buy insurance on the mortgages and set aside more capital to cover bad loans. And co-sponsor Gary Peters says the guaranteed mortgages would require a higher down payment, probably around 20%.
This legislation puts significant protections in place by putting a lot of capital ahead of any government guarantees.
Even so, Peter Wallison at the American Enterprise Institute says taxpayers will still be on the hook.
When you think about it, the buyers of those securities do not care whether those mortgages are of any value. And why should they care? Because the government is going to back them if ultimately those mortgages fail, which is exactly what happened with Fannie and Freddie.
Even though today's bill is a rare bipartisan effort, it gets in line behind a long list of congressional priorities. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not all that far from where I am right now, actually. Bad start, strong finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The setting was a high-tech conference in San Francisco. The specific scene was a guy in jeans and what looked like a mock turtleneck walking across the stage describing his company's latest and greatest new product. And yet, Steve Jobs was nowhere to be seen. The guy on stage Tuesday was Sundar Pichai. He's a senior vice president at Google. And the whiz-bang new product at hand was the company's new laptop, the Chromebook, it's called. Here to explain why yet another laptop might matter in the grand scheme of things is Marketplace's Steve Hann. Hey, Steve.
Hey.
So, laptop schmaptop, man. What's new about this Chromebook?
Well, you know, the Chromebook is kind of more like the love child of a smartphone and a laptop than an old-fashioned
nice
PC. You know, some of the models will have 3G. The software updates automatically. And Google is saying that they will lease this to universities and businesses for $20 to $30 a month. Probably one of the biggest differences, though, is there's no hard drive. So everything you normally save onto your computer, from your resume to your master's thesis, will be saved on a Google server or some other server, and it won't be yours anymore. You know, it won't be physically in your possession. But the really big difference, the thing that is scaring some people, is this thing doesn't need Microsoft software to work.
So would some of those people being scared be the ones up in Redmond, Washington, who work for Microsoft?
Yeah, I mean, they should be. I mean, this is definitely how Google plans to undercut Microsoft's software business. You know, these laptops are relatively cheap. They'll run Google apps and other web-based apps. They have word processing, spreadsheets, calendars. And, you know, Google thinks they have everything you need. So, the last time I bought a PC, I dropped like $200 to buy Microsoft Office.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I won't have to do that anymore. And businesses won't have to pay licensing fees. Those fees are the engine that's been powering Microsoft for decades. And Google's trying to pour sugar in that gas tank.
But we just saw a couple of weeks ago problems with the cloud, right, Stephen? Amazon had its servers go down. You've got your entire life up there, whether it's work projects or school projects, and Google fundamentally can't guarantee that they're always going to be able to let you have it, right?
Well, I think the argument that they would make is that actually their cloud servers are a lot more durable and redundant and safer than your laptop. You know, if your kid spills a soda on your computer and you haven't backed that stuff up, you could just be out of luck. If it gets infected with a virus and turns into a brick, you could lose everything. You know, the cloud's not perfect, but I think lots of people are going to argue over time it is better than actually holding your stuff close to home.
All right, I'm not sure I buy that one, but let me throw another one at you. The privacy aspect of this, right? You've got everything up there now. You've got whatever private personal documents you can imagine, and you don't control it, right? It's out there in the ether someplace.
Well, yeah, that's true. And, you know, if you're downloading all of your stuff onto a server, whether it's Google server or Amazon server, what they do with your information, whether it's a list of, you know, the songs you like to listen to or your diary, is really up to that company and its individual privacy policy. The other big issue with privacy is how protected you are if you're ever investigated, right? You know, hopefully the DOJ is never going to come looking at your hard drive, Kai. But if they did, you know, lots of folks think you'd be much better to have a laptop than a Chromebook. Alan Friedman's an online privacy expert at Brookings.
There is, in American law, a big distinction between the data that I currently possess on my laptop in my home and data that is stored in the cloud. Data that's stored in the cloud is not as protected.
Friedman says if, say, the feds wanted to get that data and it was on your laptop, they'd actually have to come and physically get it. That means you'd get a warrant, you'd get served, you could fight it in court. But if you're putting all of your information on a server, you know, Google is the one that gets served, and it's really up to Google whether or not they're going to fight to protect your information.
Marketplace's Steve Henn on Google's latest plan to take over the world. Steve, thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
The former chief of Pakistani intelligence weighed in on the Osama bin Laden question today. He, like many of his countrymen, thinks the United States was obliged to let Pakistan know about bin Laden's whereabouts before anything happened. That raid is just the most recent source of tension between the two countries and the possibility that certain parts of the Pakistani military or intelligence service knew bin Laden was staying there and let him stay has Congress questioning the billions in aid that Pakistan gets from the United States every year. Commentator Nancy Birdsall says lawmakers are totally missing the point.
The United States needs a diversified portfolio of both short and long-term investments in Pakistan. Washington needs the cooperation of Pakistan's military and intelligence agencies right now, so it spends billions reimbursing Pakistan's war costs. But Americans are also concerned about Pakistan's long-term stability, and with good reason. Pakistan will soon be the world's fourth most populous nation, with nuclear weapons and 100 million young people with few jobs but plenty of opportunities for radicalization. The United States should try to give these young people hope for the future as an investment in our own security. The $1.5 billion in economic aid budgeted for Pakistan this year is less than what the Pentagon spends in 1 week in Afghanistan. If aid now reduces the risk of military engagement later, just imagine how much that $1.5 billion is saving us. Of course, spending money without impact is no good for anyone. That's why we should support Pakistani programs that have the best chance of educating kids, creating jobs, and strengthening democratic institutions. The point is not to win hearts and minds. It is to help create opportunities so that Pakistan can become a more stable and prosperous place. And it's not only about aid. During a recent visit to Pakistan, Pakistanis told me that even more than aid, they want trade. Lowering tariffs on Pakistani exports would not cost U.S. jobs. We already import our shoes and clothes from elsewhere, but it could create jobs and hope for unemployed youth in Pakistan's teeming cities. Aid to Pakistan is not a bribe, and it's not charity. It's a calculated, low-cost piece of the U.S. security portfolio. It took us more than a decade of persistent effort to finally track down Osama bin Laden. The U.S. should approach development in Pakistan with the same seriousness, patience, and perseverance.
Nancy Birdsall is the president of the Center for Global Development. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says Contact. Coming up.
Unfortunately, some of them seem to be very hard for people to remember and to say.
The high cost of creative drug names. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street took an early dive but bounced back strong today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 65 points, 0.5%, closed at 12,695. The NASDAQ added 17 points, about 2/3%, finished at 2,863. The S&P 500 gained 6 points. 0.5%, ended things at $13.48. We told you about how high gasoline prices are hitting U.S. consumers. Well, investors welcomed a rise in oil prices today. Oilfield services company Schlumberger scored a 1.5% gain. Chevron bubbled up 0.5% as its CEO and other oil executives defended industry tax breaks at a Senate hearing. Retailers rounding up some gains. Walmart tacked on 1%. Discount chain Dollar Tree bulked up by 3%. Saks rose 0.9% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines. And by Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, which monitors mileage and safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. Learn more at progressive.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Friday. A House subcommittee will meet tomorrow to discuss whether or not the U.S. Constitution should be amended to address the federal deficit. Songwriter Stevie Wonder turns 61 tomorrow, sharing a birthday with Stephen Colbert. He'll be 47. And those of you with frigatriskaidekaphobia, beware. It's the only Friday the 13th of 2011. I'm Christina Sarnelli.
This is Marketplace from APM, that's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Things are looking a little bit brighter for the music industry. For the first time in 6 years, sales are up. More than 1.5% better this year than last. That's according to Nielsen, the ratings people. They say there are all kinds of reasons for the bump, including, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains, maybe the best one, music that people think is worth paying for.
The upshot of the Nielsen report is that we're buying fewer CDs, but we are still buying music. Russ Krupnik is an entertainment analyst for the NPD Group, which is a market research firm.
We're seeing really good growth in terms of the number of people who are coming in and buying digital downloads. And we're seeing really good growth in the number of people who are buying digital albums. So that's positive.
Krupnik says, as with so many new technologies, the challenge is how to make money from it. Although music sales have risen in terms of units sold, in terms of dollars, the business still isn't doing so well. That may get better. Nielsen says people are paying more for music. Many single downloads now go for $1.29 rather than the 99 cents they cost originally. Dan Keene is a professor at Belmont University. He says one thing that's really helping is good new music. The British singer Adele's CD 21 recently became the most downloaded album ever on Amazon.
It's not just about a groove, although that's part of it, or about a great production, but it's the pathos and the ethos in her voice that really connects with people.
Whether it's Adele, the Beatles, who are now available on iTunes, or Lady Gaga, people are getting more and more tunes online. And music to the ears of the industry, less and less from illegal file shares. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Steve Henn and I were talking about Google a little while ago, what it's doing in the cloud and its new laptop. Now another technology item, how companies take your clicks, build a profile of who you are and what you like, and then reflect that back to you in your online life. The idea is the building block for Eli Pariser's new book, The Filter Bubble, how personalization is changing the web and us. Eli, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me on.
So what's happening here, in essence, is that the internet is turning into my internet. Is that a fair summation?
Yeah, that's right. Kind of invisibly, without people noticing, websites are beginning to cater themselves to what you individually want to see. So, for example, if you search on Google for, say, Bin Laden or Obama, and I search for that same term at the same time, we may see very different results. And this is kind of spreading across the internet.
All right. Well, isn't that a good thing? Because I don't necessarily want to see what you want to see.
Well, it can be. But the problem is that people don't really know that it's happening. And at times, what it means is that things that are really important or that might be unexpected and or challenging views don't get seen. Instead, you see what you want to see, which feels very comfortable, but can lead to really bad decisions.
Take me behind the scenes, if you will, behind that Google algorithm. I mean, they actually are changing things to personalize the web for you.
That's right. They're basically watching every single thing that you do online and trying to figure out, you know, sort of what are you interested in? And that then informs what they show you. And this isn't just happening on Google. It's happening on a whole range of sites, including increasingly news sites. So Yahoo News shows different front pages to different people. And the Washington Post and the New York Times are both experimenting with this kind of thing. Basically, instead of doing what great media does, which is push us out of our comfort zone at times and show us things that we wouldn't expect to like, wouldn't expect to want to see, is showing us sort of this very narrowly constructed zone of what is most relevant to you.
This has to be incredibly lucrative for companies, right? They get these similar thinking people, they know how to monetize them, and then they can just sell, baby, sell.
That's right. No, it's a huge profit center. And that's why every major company on the internet is doing a ton of research into how it can personalize every little piece of what it's doing. And I think, you know, these companies, whereas they until recently were kind of insurgents, now they're really responsible for the flows of information in our society that people use to vote and to make important decisions and to, you know, run their businesses. And they need to kind of incorporate that same sense of professional ethics that journalists have had in the 20th century media.
Is there a place for government here? I mean, should we regulate ourselves out of the filter bubble?
Well, I think there probably is a role for government. I think, you know, some of it relies on individuals changing their behavior. Some of it relies on companies changing their behavior. But we're living with laws that regulate how you use personal information that are 20 years old. And they just never contemplated the idea that you would have these billion-dollar businesses built on people turning over their most intimate details of their lives. And, you know, I think that probably needs to be overhauled because it's a fairly simple idea to say, I gave you this data. I want to have some control over how you use it. I want to have some understanding of when you're using it. And I want to make sure that it's my decision, not your decision, who you share it with. Those are kind of basic protections that currently don't exist under U.S. law.
Eli Pariser. His new book is called The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. We've got an excerpt on our website. It's on our book blog, marketplace.org/thebigbook. Eli, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
Stay with me now on this next setup. Is it Injuvia or Januvia? Ritalin or Ritadrine? If you're confused, so are pharmacists and hospitals. Drug mix-ups, when your doctor orders one thing and you get something else, cost the healthcare system millions of dollars in unnecessary care every year. And more importantly, people die because of it. There's a case to be made, though, that the trouble starts with creative types, brainstorming the perfect brand name. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
Here's what a name can do. George DiDomizio tells me the story of two drugs. Diazide. And
Modjuretic.
Same exact chemical compound.
Identical. The companies had about the same number of salespeople, all reaching the same doctors. Diazide outsold Modjuretic by about 5-1. The only difference was the trademark.
DiDomizio likes this story because he's a professional drug namer. He's the guy who came up with Pepcid, Bextra, Prilosec, and other blockbusters. Naming a drug, he says, is harder than naming a cereal or a car because there's a whole other agency involved, the Food and Drug Administration. The FDA even has a special unit just to decide if the name overpromises, so no panaceums or correct-alls.
Some years ago, I was working with J&J on a hormonal supplement called Perfest, P-E-R-F-E-S-T. And the FDA came back and said, you know, that sounds too much like the perfect estrogen, so you can't have it.
George swapped two letters to Prefest, and they gave it to him. But having passed that test, he faced another unit at the FDA. It decides if the name could be confused with one of the 300,000 drug names already on the market.
Okay, so you just want me to go through them page by page? Omicor, Amicar, Celexa, Zyprexa.
Susan Prue reads from a list of drug names most often confused by pharmacists and doctors.
Avista, Avenza, Vitorin, Vicodin.
The FDA is getting stricter about avoiding these potential mix-ups. Last year, the FDA turned down almost half the names they heard. Prue runs a company called MedAirs, E-R-R-S, that helps drug makers test their names before they submit them to the FDA. For drug companies, it's a kind of insurance. It can cost over $500,000 to create and register a name around the world, only to have it rejected by the federal agency.
There's thousands upon thousands of names that have been considered look and sound alike.
And then there's a wild card of a doctor's bad handwriting. So imagine your doctor writes Lipitor and the pharmacist dispenses Zyrtec, an allergy drug. That's right, Lipitor and Zyrtec get confused.
The L looks like a Z, the Y can look like the downstroke of the letter P, and then at the end, T-E-C can look like T-O-R.
So it's not block letters compared to block letters to evaluate similarity. Now it's a potentially scribbled name, and scribbles look a lot alike.
The FDA's new handwriting tests have subtly altered the art of drug naming. You see more names exploring fresh linguistic territory, like names with double X's or XG or double K.
And they feel that, well, if I put two K's in the word, then maybe someone won't see that one K upstroke when you write it as an L or a T. Unfortunately, some of them seem to be very difficult to pronounce, and I think that will make them maybe less prone for confusion, but just hard for people to remember and to say.
It's getting to be a little bit like the Czechoslovakian, the Slovak language, where you have a predominance of consonants, difficult to pronounce, difficult to deal with.
That's because you old-timers used up all the vowels.
That's because, that's right.
At 75 years old, Di D'Amizio looks forward to that bright day when doctors toss aside their pens and all we have to worry about is typos. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
See for yourself how badly a doctor's handwriting can mess things up. There's video on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at chevyvolt.com. By Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at Putnam.com/large cap equity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, just a bit more on gas prices to end back where we started. Who's to blame for those prices is a moderately hot topic of conversation these days. So we went out and asked.
I just believe it's part of the cartel.
I guess we could be all riding bikes, but that's only practical to a certain point. And we're driving the market, and so they're controlling it.
I blame many past presidencies for not looking at our standards of fuel efficiency.
Well, I'm sure it has to do with, you know, what's going on over in Libya and other places where we get our oil supply from.
For it to climb, you know, 20 cents overnight or something, that seems a little unusual. Almost like the gas stations are sort of just doing it and making money off of us because they know we all need to fill up our gas tank.
That was Jeff Romo and Sarah Worley in Portland, Oregon. Matt Donahoe of Durham, North Carolina. Paul Kress and Jenny Meredith from Alexandria, Virginia as well. And that is it for us. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Thursday. Today, the Dow climbed 65 points, about a half percent. The NASDAQ added 17 points, two-thirds percent. The S&P 500 gained 6 points, a half percent. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Thanks today to the staff here at WNYC. And coming up next time, back here, back in L.A., this is prom season, you know, but forget the dresses. The men are where the money's at.
A store pays about $150 for a tux and rents it out for about $150, typically more than 10 times.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.